Blog Talk Radio.
Well, I've had one too many cigarettes, burning up my lungs. Had to taste of one too many lips, hanging off my tongue. Oh, oh, oh. Sunday morning, getting high, drinking here alone. Thinking up a brand new alibi for not coming home. Oh, oh.
Celebrate people who, like the founder of this show, recognize they're on a dangerous path and make the difficult adjustment to be an amazing person. Share poems that reveal the duality of our vulnerability and strength. Capture the internal battle of the demon and angel on your shoulders. Deep poetry, thoughtful commentary, and fun chatter for sinners, saints, and everyone in between. This is part sinner, part saint, part of Late Night Poets on allpoetry.com. You don't have to be in the group to participate, but if you do, you can read along with us, make comments, and talk to us in the chat. So we'd love to have you join us. I'm Afasiana, and with me, I believe, I have Babbler.
You believe correctly.
Woo-hoo.
How's it going?
You think I would know your number by now? A number pops up and I'm like, that's going to be her. That's. I'm
changed.
Just going to assume that's Babbler. How are you tonight?
Oh, I'm good. I'm tired. I worked, you know, late. It's audit season, so just working. Say about it. My mom came over for me to give her an injection, which I've never done in my life. She's like, you've done this before. And I'm like, no, I haven't. But I'll figure it out. So I did. Well, yeah. I worked at the Red Cross in their blood services department, but I processed, like, already collected blood. I didn't draw blood. Like, at no point did I do phlebotomy.
And taking it out is different than putting something in, too. Like, it's a whole other skill.
Yeah, it's not the same. It's not the same. Not at all.
Wow. You are now upgraded to partial nurse.
That scares me. What have you been up to?
Just tidying my house. You know, nothing too exciting. My library is closed for 4 days for the weekend, so I'm off. But, you know, there's lots of chores that I have been slacking on. So I'm catching up. It's not a very glamorous holiday weekend, but needs to be done. And it's good to have some rest. It's been a big seizure month. I don't know what's going on that's different, but it's just my brain is scrambled. So I need a reset. But I also doubled my meds. So if I'm a little bit dopey, I'm still trying to experiment to see at what point I am both stable and coherent. We'll see how that goes.
All right.
This is going to be fun. On Saturday last weekend, I started to have a seizure at work, so I took my Ativan. And I don't know if you ever had Ativan, but it gets me quite the bounce. So I was just like, "Woo! Look at the ceiling!" And people were like, "It's like a plain white ceiling." And I'm like, "No, not anymore." It was an embarrassing scene. All right, so moving along to the poetry, we have a few carryovers. From last week, and the prompts last week were, your boundaries need not be angry electric fences that shock those who touch it. It can be consistent light around you that announces, I will be treated sacredly, which was by Jaya John. And there's the quote, eventually the light in your heart will reach your spine and the fear will forget where you live. And that one was by D. Antoinette Foy. So those were the prompts, and we have two carryovers from that contest. Babbler 1, I'm going to get you to read the first one, which is by Average White Man.
Absolutely. There it is. Wasn't popping up for a second. For some reason, my internet is a little bit slow today. This is One Day by Average White Man. One fine day, the light of love will reach you. You'll flinch, of course, for you have lived too long without its push and stretch, folding life to tendon and sinew. One fine day, fear of joy will be banished from your inner courtyard, bringing a glow to kidneys, steel to spines, and firing synapses in your fragile mind. One day, you'll reach for a touch and take flight from the night. Life will wrap around your glorious frame, a choir of unified light igniting the rain. One fine day, I pray. End quote.
Great read. I really love this, actually. It has a recognition that for some people, accepting love is difficult. It's not that they can't give love. It's that, you know, people build defenses after they've been hurt, after they've thought they had love that was not really love. And to have that kind of light where you flinch at first because you're afraid of believing in it. You're afraid of the consequences of it, like if you've been hurt in what's felt like love before. I like that it recognizes that, but then it talks about how like you've lived too long without it and you don't know how to deal with it. And it's sort of like when you've been in the dark and then you go outside in the sun and you feel blinded, like just completely, like it's too much. And eventually you adjust, but at first it's just like, whoa, can't see at all. And if you're used to being alone, then suddenly having someone there can be like that, where it's just like overwhelming. And then I like the phrasing of from your inner courtyard. So if there was that inner courtyard, that means you have the walls built up around it. Your happy place is very well guarded. It's not just, you know, a front yard that people can go by. That inner courtyard is where there's potential for joy. But now finally it's not full of fear. And then how it spreads to the different body parts, like steel to the spine makes you stronger, which is part of the quote, that was the prompt. And, you know, firing synapses, letting you produce that dopamine and serotonin that you need. I think that this used the right amount of metaphor and the right amount of science, and it was just like a connection that worked really well. Well done, average white man. What did you think, Babbler?
I really liked it. You know, for me, I felt like it was about someone who doesn't know love, has never known love, so they're just kind of in the dark, you know, and that hopefully one day, you know, this is like a prayer on the person's behalf, you know, that one day they will know love, that they will feel love, and that it is shocking, you know, suddenly. And it makes me think of me as a youth when, you know, people would tell me they liked me and I'd just look at them in disbelief. You know, like, I was very defensive about it because I wasn't used to, like, receiving affection, you know, and I certainly didn't think anyone would be romantically interested in me. And, you know, so I was very defensive and it took a long time for me to figure out how to, like, accept compliments and accept that people can love me, you know. And so now that I've, you know, gotten older and experienced more of that, I feel like I'm a lot more receptive. And I feel like that's kind of what this is about. Like, I hope you open up. Like, I hope someone gets love that day, you know, you'll reach out for it and you'll appreciate it and it'll touch you. You know, I do love how some of it is so visceral, you know, the tendons and the sinews and a glow to kidneys, steel spines and firing synapses, you know, a very physical aspect of it, like anatomical, you know, which, you know, you had mentioned like dopamine and things like that, the chemical side of love, which I can absolutely, you know, understand here, but just like the good feeling that comes with that. So I really enjoyed it. I thought it was well done. So thank you, Average White Man.
Well said, Babbler. Our next poem is by Vamped Vixen, and this was to the same prompts. The Thing by Vamped Vixen. We all have a thing. It scares me to even mention it, thing. I know I have to do it, though, thing. An insomniac shivering in the night, wearing holes in the floors from pacing. Why is adulting so fucking hard, thing? A why won't it go away, thing. I don't want to look at it, thing. A why can't I just be a fucking adult and look at it, thing. I'm making an appointment on a phone that weighs 1,000 pounds, thing. A panic attack just from thinking about it, thing. I know I'm sick, but doctor needles scare me, thing. Why is there no one else to do it for me, thing. A fear will choke me if I let it, thing. A conversation with strangers shouldn't feel like daring myself to dive into acid, thing. why does it have to be me who does it thing? A why am I letting it keep me from having a life thing? A ramming my head into the wall would be easier thing. I'm letting it steal sand of my hourglass. I've been thinking about it for weeks, but this procrastination is my only safety thing. I'm tired of these fucking mental health battles, executive dysfunction, misfiring synapses. It shouldn't be this hard thing. But on this day, at this hour, you rode into the war. You kept running from, and you defeated the thing. The thing that thought it had you beat. You stood up. You did not let it own you. You said, no, it will not destroy me. I refuse, I refuse, I refuse. So now you come home, fresh from victory, laurel wreaths on weary head, and those voices calling you a coward are shamed, because on this day, you fought and won. And maybe there is no applause. The cheers you deserve may not come, because no one knows how hard it is just to do that one thing. But even if the war continues, future battles to plan and wage, by God, you will do it again and again and again, and it will not stop you. You are a fucking soldier, and you have earned your stripes. I salute you. End poem.
Fantastic read. I loved with how much emotion and anger you read this. But I also just really enjoy the poem. The thing. We all have a thing. I have a lot of things. You know, I have generalized anxiety disorder plus bipolar, which is great, which is really great. So I either get, like, so anxious and high-strung that I can't do things, or I'm so low energy and internalizing my anxiety that I can't do things. Yeah, I a lot of times I'm not in the middle, and I get very frustrated because I lack, like, executive function, which is what a lot of these are, you know. The being a fucking adult and looking at it, the making an appointment on the phone, just thinking about it, you know. I have trouble making phone calls. I have trouble making appointments. I have trouble paying bills. It's not that I forget to pay the bill. It's that I think about the bill and then I can't pay it. And a lot of that, I think, comes from growing up without money. You know, it just gives me anxiety knowing there's a bill and then I can't pay the bill. And now the thing I was anxious about came true because of the anxiety. I love these. These are wonderful, like, horrible roundabout things. But this is, like, literally my existence, and it's exhausting. It's really exhausting. And every day it's hard. Have a to-do list that's 5 miles long and not be able to do anything. The best way that I know how to do anything is to start with a list and do the easiest part first. And so then I feel like I at least accomplished something. work down until I'm getting to the hardest stuff. Or to just start with a really, really small goal. Like, sometimes I'll just be like, I'm going to put 5 things away, and then it'll yarn into something else because I'll put 1 thing away, and then I'll see something else that needs to be put away, and then I'll see something else that just kind of strings together. So I felt very, like, personally attached to this piece because this is literally my mind. And on the days where I win, those are really good. So it's nice to feel a little bit like there's a cheerleader out there, you know? And I feel like she has to have experienced this to be able to write it like this. To really put into words like that particular fight, that particular struggle, the inability to do anything. And it sounds so silly and it sounds so stupid, but it's like, it can be really extreme. You know, it can be really extreme. Or you don't want to admit to anybody, like, how extreme it's actually gotten. I didn't, you know, I got out of bed and I went to work, but then I came home and went right back to bed. And it's like, well, I didn't shower for 3 weeks. I didn't brush my hair. I didn't brush my teeth. My hair is matted. I feel disgusting, but I have no energy to do anything else. And it's really hard to deal with. It's hard to talk to people about. And it's like, you know, just one of those things. Or it's the opposite, and it's like I'm doing so many things and I'm so burnt out, and then I just feel like I missed something and I'm going to get screamed at, and that's hanging out over my head every day, all day, and then I end up, like, having a panic attack in the bathroom. So it's wonderful. But I really enjoyed this piece because I felt very, very connected to it. I'm not telling anybody, you know, like, go read my poems, but I think if you read a lot of my poems or any of my poems that are really kind of autobiographical connection, is exactly what is addressed here. So I loved it, Bam. Thank you. What did you think? Yeah.
Well, first of all, everyone go read Babbler's poems. I'm going to say it if she's afraid to. So go read them. But also, I completely agree. I got really into this one because it's how I feel a lot of the time. I have anxiety problems as well. And, man, this was relatable. And that kind of thing where you know that is something that you should be able to do. So I really liked the part where it was like, and why can't I just be a fucking adult and look at the thing? Because sometimes it's like that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I feel like a small thing mm-hmm. is really huge, but sometimes I know it's small, and I'm like, just do the thing and it'll be fine. Once you do it, it'll all be fine. But I can't. I just can't. And I'm like, why can't I be a functional person who just does the thing? And sometimes I can't. And I totally relate to what you said, Babbler, about the hair thing, because, you know, sometimes I am not able to deal with my hair, and it's really bad. And then I end up having to go to, like, the hairdresser just to deal with my hair, not even, like, to cut it for the sake of having it cut. It was just, like, I need you to wash my hair and make it not matted. Because that happens. It's a thing. And people don't get it. And it took me a really long time to find a hairdresser who would, you know, not make fun of me terribly for that happening. And it just, she captures that anxiety so well that she must have felt it. Because I like that she doesn't necessarily put it as one specific thing. She gives examples like being afraid to make the call, which is a common anxiety. You know, it's funny because we do these shows on the phone, right? And I hate making phone calls. I'm okay with doing these shows for some reason. And there was somebody, a comedian, who was making a joke about how millennials are afraid to make phone calls unless it's a podcast, because it's like, it doesn't make sense. It's a podcast where nobody's recording you. You should be less nervous. But somehow more nervous. I don't know. For just, like, ridiculous things. And, like, I feel like we've become spoiled in a way of people with anxiety, because you can order things online and not have to talk to anyone. Like, before, I probably would have eaten, like, way less pizza because, talking to a real person is difficult. Being able to communicate, like, my allergies and the things that I want and blah, blah, blah. It's, like, so much easier to be picky on a screen. And then also to admit that, like, yeah, I'm having pizza again. If the computer doesn't judge me, I can do it. So things like that where she points out the fears of little things like that that can feel big. And, you know, doctor's needles is a thing that a lot of people have issues with. I used to. I've had so many now that the only time it bothers me is if I have, like, a flashback to a bigger situation with one, but most of the time I'm good. But everyone has their own thing, and I like that she acknowledges that, you know, not everyone's thing is the same. But I really love the way that she makes the rhythm. I don't know exactly how she did it, but it had this urgency to it. The whole time I felt the anxiety as I was reading it. And I don't think that's just because I relate, but I feel like she put that in there. There's a pacing to it that works really well. Partly the way she has at the end of lines, the little dashes or the periods that are like dot, 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 like more is coming. And she has repetition, I refuse, I refuse, I refuse. there's an urgency and a feeling that just keeps it flowing very quickly. Like, and again, and again, and again, and just, like, putting, like, only that on a line. And then at the end, there's that acknowledgement of, I salute you. And, you know, in some cases, that would have been kind of sarcastic, but I didn't take it that way with this. It's the actual recognition of, like, that little thing you did was a big deal for you, and I honor that. So I felt this one, like, deep. I related to it hard. So thank you, Vamped Vixen, for sharing this.
Yeah, no, I found it very relatable. I just wanted to share real quick, just to, while I'm thinking about it, you know, the part where you talked about, you know, yelling at yourself, essentially, because you're really frustrated because you know that something is really simple and really easy and it's going to take 2 seconds to do it, and it's really not that hard and it shouldn't be that hard, but you just can't seem to do it. When I started, like, really berate myself for those things, you know, one of the biggest things I took away from, like, my cognitive behavioral therapy is that, like, if you wouldn't say it to someone else, don't say it to yourself. You know, if you would never think or say that about somebody else, there's no reason to talk to yourself like that either. And I would never treat somebody else like that. If they told me, hey, I'm really having a hard time and I can't get this simple thing done, I wouldn't be like, well, you're a stupid piece of shit. Like, you know, like, I would never, like, it seems ridiculous. So, you know, it kind of helps me to laugh at it and at least get out of, while it doesn't help me do the thing, it helps me get out of that derogatory mindset. So I just thought I'd share that just in case other people have experienced similar and maybe it's helpful.
I think that is helpful. I think my problem is that I've had people in my life who did speak to me like that because they thought it was stupid that I couldn't do the little thing. So I think about them, but you're right, I wouldn't say it. So I'll just have to, you know, turn the tables there. Would I say it to someone?
Yeah, would you say it? Not would they. There are other a-holes that say all kinds of horrible shit to people. Let's not go by what they would say.
Yes. Good point. All right, I'm going to go with that. Today we're going to be doing your Violet poems, the one from the last of your rainbow contests. And Daniel DeShino, who has entered all of your contests about color, wrote a special one that he wasn't going to show us because it was just sort of like a thing that he did, where in protest of brown not being included, because at one point you had said that you liked the color brown, and yesterday on our show Double Helix, he was joking about how he got on this rant about how brown may be a mix of all of the other colors, but it's its own special thing. So he wrote a ranting poem about the importance of colors beyond the rainbow. So at some point, we need to read that. I put it on our board.
Okay. Well, if we don't get to it too, it's okay, because I have hinted and alluded to the fact that I intended to do some other non-rainbow colors, because brown is one of my favorite colors. It's always funny because people ask me, what's your favorite color? And I usually say yellow, which is true, but I also really like brown. And I have a lot of stuff that I own that's brown because I like brown. But it always feels kind of weird to say that, like, brown's my favorite color, but it kind of is, you know? Like, so, you know, I also was planning on giving those non-rainbow shades a bit of a nod. They deserve attention, too. So even if we don't get it tonight, we can get into it somewhere.
It will get its day.
Yeah, it will have its moment.
All right, that's good. Because when he mentioned it, I'm like, well, we have to at least show Battler. Like, come on.
Yeah. Well, I don't have much to say about introduction on this contest. I mean, it is literally about the color purple or violet, whatever that inspires, whatever that conjures in your mind. You know, I put some you know, little bits of inspiration up for people who like that kind of thing, you know, who just want that little extra nudge, which I'm happy to provide. Some quotes, some images to just kind of help inspire. So in case any of them are based on those, I'll go ahead and give an outline of what that is. The first quote was from William Shakespeare, and it's, "Flower of this purple dye, hit with Cupid's archery, sink in the apple of his eye." The second was a photograph of lilacs by Mara Tyler. The third quote was, "I won't eat any cereal that doesn't turn the milk purple," by Bill Watterson. The fourth was a painting by Enrico Moses of Prince, done entirely in purple. The fifth was the quote, "Stars will blossom in the darkness, violets bloom beneath the snow," by Julia Caroline Doerr. Prompt six was a candy bar from Australia called the Violet Crumble, which I've had before. It is super weird. Like, nothing else I've ever eaten has tasted like this. Like, there's nothing comparable. I've actually mentioned this candy bar more times than I can think of because there's nothing that tastes like this. I don't know what else to say about it. It has this really interesting, like, velvet sweet texture. Anyway, number seven is a quote. "This is the violet hour, the hour of hush and wonder, when the affectations glow and valor is reborn, when the shadows bend along the edge of the forest, and we believe that, if we watch carefully, at any moment we may see the unicorn," by Bernard DeVoto. I'll also mention a couple things that I mentioned in the text because a couple people have comments on those too. I mentioned violence just because the color violet kind of shares a root with that. And I also thought of veterans because Purple Hearts. And I said a certain cycloptic gobbler of bipedal apes, which was an allusion to a one-eyed, one-horned flying purple people eater. Those were the prompts. But really, anything purple-related was welcome to the board.
It's fun to see how many people have different thoughts when it comes to something like a color. It means different things to different people.
Mm-hmm.
So the first entry that I have here is by Marvin Goldfarb, and it's called "The Purple of the Order." Purple is the color of royalty. Sipping on their royal tea, creating a majestic mystery. So as you can see, purple it shall be. End poem.
Great read if easy on it. And I like the different references in here too. The purple of the order makes me think veterans, but it doesn't necessarily mean that as the title. And then the lines themselves, you know, are just, "The purple is the color of royalty, royal purple, not a deep, deep purple that so many, like, royal, like, very expensive clothing was made out of when dyes were a lot harder to come by." You know, blues in particular, I know, were very difficult, which is why royal blue is such a thing. But purple wasn't super far behind that either. So I like that they used that one because that's not one of the ones that I suggested. But I can see, like, these people, you know, bougie people sitting there drinking their tea, looking fancy in their purple. It had great rhyme and flow. It was a nice little brevity. So thank you, Marvin. Your thoughts, Ephesiana?
Yeah, I really liked the wordplay of royalty and royal tea. Anytime where you can make the word work in multiple ways is fun. And purple definitely was a rare color. I do a lot of historical reenactment stuff, and even within my reenactment world, you're only allowed to wear purple if you've earned it. Only the royalty can do it. Now, within our society, you you can earn royalty through combat. So it's a little different than inherited royalty, but still you have to be of a certain status, which is earned through skill, to wear the purple if you're in strict circles, which not always. But it had big meaning at some times because, like you said, the dye was not readily available, and it created a visual of the class divide, which I'm actually not fond of, but it's interesting historically. And now there's so much more freedom with color, and it's just interesting how, in a way, it has less meaning, because there were also many times, and it changed throughout history, which was which, but where colors were very gendered, and now most younger generations, color is not really something that you worry too much about. Like, you know, if a baby girl is wearing blue, you don't think much of it, or at least I don't. And there was times when that was like a direct indication of gender. So color has changed in its meaning in some ways, and purple definitely was royalty at one point. I think this was a really nice brevity. It had some nice cadence to it, and there's rhyme. But I think my favorite part is the royalty, which I probably am not saying different enough that people know what I'm talking about. Royalty, R-O-Y-A-L-T-Y, and royalty, R-O-Y-A-L space T-E-A. The double use of that is cool.
Yes, one is a ruling class of people, and the other one is the steep beverage.
Yes. Thank you, Babbler, for clarifying. I knew it, but I didn't know how to express it.
It is a nice bit of wordplay. I enjoyed it. Where are we off to?
Now we have one by Damn It, Dave. If you can read that one for us.
Absolutely. Is Lilacs in the Spring by Damn It, Dave. Her love is just a memory now, but oh, the joy we shared. When death took her away from me, I wasn't quite prepared. But oh, when April comes again, what joy that month will bring, for nothing makes me think of her in the spring. The perfume that she used to wear bore that syringa scent, and now the fragrance of those blooms can't help but represent the love I have that cannot die. She was my everything, and nothing makes me think of her like lilacs in the spring. End of poem.
This is beautiful. It reminds me a lot of a poem that you wrote, Babbler. I don't remember what kind of flower it was, but it was about the loss of someone as well. And I feel a connection there. Was it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no wonder it reminded me of it. I guess it's one of those ones where it's very distinct, and if you have a connection to someone with it, it's you can smell it, you can see it from far away. It's one that hits you hard, because they are something that really shows up, and you can it engages all of your senses. Beautiful poem, and you know, it has a nice tribute to this lost person, the woman who is missed, and that's the way he worded some things, in kind of an old fashioned way, like, just a memory now is spelt M-E-M-apostrophe-R-Y, memory. Somehow that just makes it more quaint. There, I don't know, there are some spellings where it kind of shows the accent that I'm terrible at saying it in a way that it's supposed to sound, but it reads in my head in this old-fashioned way that I really enjoy. I like that this engaged multiple senses and that it tugs at our heartstrings. What did you think, Babbler?
It's funny that you mentioned my poem, because this also made me think of the one that I wrote. So I, not that long ago, wrote a poem called Lilacs in August. And that's because my father's favorite flower was a lilac. And he passed away when I was young, and we buried him under a lilac tree. And lilacs usually bloom the first week of May. I moved to this house in June, and there weren't any lilacs here. And I'm used to having a bunch of them. They usually cut them from the lilacs we buried my father under, but I didn't have any this time. So I had to go and buy lilacs, which is fine. And I planted them, and then I went on a trip to Chicago. And while I was there, my nephew died in a car accident on my father's birthday. Which was also the day I got back, which was August 2nd. So I went to go look at my lilacs because I was thinking of my dad and my nephew, and it was blooming. My lilac was blooming in August, which just doesn't happen. That is, like, way off season for a lilac to bloom. And I took a photo of it, but it was just so odd. So I totally relate to seeing people in lilacs, because I relate them to my dad. So to see this and to really remember someone based on a lilac is incredibly relatable to me. This is more tied, I think, to the smell, you know, her perfume. She wore a lilac perfume. And so now every spring, when he smells that smell, it brings it right back. And scent can be so strong, too. Scent can be such a memory tie. I can identify smells that I was from when I was a kid. I'm not even sure what they are, but when I smell them, it takes me right back. The oil you'd put in an old lawnmower, like an old ride-on lawnmower. You know, it's like gasoline, and it's got oil in it, too, and it's just that very distinct smell. Smells the same as, like, chainsaw gas mix or, wood chips, you know, just that kind of thing. It's got that nice nostalgia to it. The rhyming and the cadence of this piece feels almost Elizabethan. Like, it feels very perfect, like it's in a perfect meter. I'm terrible at counting meter, so I'm sorry, Dave. It sounds like it is, but I can't. I'm terrible at that. I know what it is, but I just, my brain does not enjoy the effort of trying to count that. So I don't. But it feels, the flow feels very much on meter, which is also, I'm assuming, why you would drop the syllable from memory to make it two syllables to hit the IM. But I really enjoyed it. It gave it a very classic feel. It almost felt like a sonnet. A couple lines too many, but other than that, it's not even a couple lines too many. It's just the wrong divisions. So I really liked it. I thought it was well done.
That was a great comment. Everyone should go read Babbler's poem and see the connections there. I'm just going to keep plugging your poems, by the way. This next poem is, no, it's good. I will. Purple Pop Star by My Angels 3. If purple were a flavor, I would create a dessert to savor a little taste of your rainbow. From the colors of your soul, I'd find a way to make purple pop upon your taste buds like an art. It's more than anyone can give, but I mean it from the heart. For if purple were a flavor, I would swallow purple whole with an orange zest. I would taste what's blessed from the colors of your soul. End poem.
Wonderful read. I love just the idea of starting this out with, if purple were a flavor, then what would it taste like? And all these wonderful different things, you know, it would be a dessert. It would taste like your soul, you know, it would taste of your rainbow, and the colors of your soul. It would pop like an art. And I love that because it's a play on pop art, which is they used the purple artwork of Prince by Enrico Moses for the reference here. And it is a piece of pop art. So I love the idea of making it pop like an art, but as a flavor instead of a color, I thought was really creative, you know, and to swallow it whole with an orange zest, you know, just the juxtaposition of flavors. It's purple and yellow, I believe, are contrary colors, and not, yeah, because it's blue and orange, purple and yellow, complementary colors. But it's still pretty off, and so there's contrast there between the two. I would taste what's blessed from the colors of your soul. So if purple were a flavor, it would taste like all of these incredibly artful, fun, lighthearted pieces of you, which I think is a really cool way to take this. It feels almost like synesthetic, like to take all these different senses and make them into taste, like what would a color taste like? I enjoy it. I thought this was really well done. Really fun, a fun, lighthearted piece. What did you think, Faziana?
I thought it was really fun, too. And I actually have synthesazy. I can't even say the word. I'm going to sneeze. Hold on. Sorry about that. I have synthasia, which is basically my senses are all jumbled up. So sometimes colors do have taste for me, or tastes have colors, or sounds have colors. It just, you know, I'm all mixed up like that. And purple does have kind of a flavor when I look at it. And it would go really well with orange zest. I know that she's not being literal with this, but I take it in a literal way, and I like it. And I like the idea of trying to capture someone in a flavor. It's like, you know, sometimes at weddings or birthday parties or whatever, they'll make like a signature drink that is like supposed to represent the person, and usually it's just kind of because they chose it for the way that it looks. But it, I mean, you sort of are in this because you're picking the color, but trying to capture the essence of someone and show everyone how wonderful they are by showing off that taste. And it's like, if I could make a recipe that shows like how amazing that is, turn it into art. That's just really cool. And I think the orange zest thing kind of works with, like, the drink idea, too, because I'm picturing, like, when it has, like, the orange peel on the side of the drink, and that would look really good on a purple drink. so it's bringing the flavor to life. And then it says in the AN that her first ever concert was going to see Prince. So she has a connection as well. Where she has this memory of Prince, which works really well. Pop star, pop art, this whole thing kind of circles around and works nicely together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm glad you read the footnote. It's just kind of cool to see people whose first concerts were certain people. Mine is someone no one would ever guess, so... It's weird how things work like that. But,
now I want to guess.
what would you guess, just if you had to guess?
Because you've talked like Trailer Park, I'm leaning towards country, even though I don't see you as a country listener. And I'm going to say, like, Willie Nelson.
No. I do listen to some country music, but no. My first ever concert I went to was Slipknot.
Wow.
So, which is not my particular genre of music. Like, I don't think even most of my friends would have guessed that if they hadn't already known. Yes, and that was because it was a good friend of mine's favorite band, and we went for his birthday. So I went because he wanted to go.
Nice.
But I grew up really drunk because I'd never been to a concert before, so that was my first concert. Yeah.
For me, it depends on if you count. Like, I saw Fred Penner when I was a little kid. So, like, but my first, like, grown-up concert, sort of, like, even though I was 16, was Vertical Horizon, which they were never huge. So. Do you know who they are? Okay, cool.
I love them.
I love them.
I absolutely love them.
Okay, they were my first concert. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if I was allowed to be there because it was in a bar and I was quite young. But I must have been because I got in. And I was not very sneaky. So I remember thinking it was so cool. I was in a bar listening to Vertical Horizon. Wasn't a very big venue. So, yeah. Sometimes it's the opening act, too, that you end up liking better than the other one. I went to see Theory of a Dead Man, who I do like, but their opening act was Econoline Crush, and Econoline Crush crushed it. Like, their live performance was more exciting to me than Theory of a Dead Man. Theory of a Dead Man, they were kind of like, they looked bored. They were like, look at this little crap town we're in. I can't even believe we're here. Kind of like look on their face. It was like, why are we doing this? Whereas Econoline Crush was like pumped to do it, and they were so into it. So I sometimes end up liking the intro band more.
That happens, especially if the headliner has been doing it for a while and they're a bit tired. The younger openers come with all the energy. But yeah. Anyway, a bit of a detour there.
Yes, we got on a sidetrack, as I do, as we do. This one time I apologized to someone because I'm like, yeah, we were talking about your poem, and then I went off on like this big thing, and they're like, that's the best part about your show, and I'm like, okay, good, because I'm going to keep doing it.
I think it's what makes it conversational. You know, it's where does the poem take you, and then allow you to explore that a bit. If you, I don't know. I personally like it when that happens. You know, it may not be like the most efficient use of time if you're trying to get through a ton of things, but I personally like to explore each piece and where what it makes me think of. So I like that.
I'm with you. I enjoy it. It makes it fun to do. So good. We're on the same page then. Our next poem is by The Birthday Boy. I don't know if his birthday is today or tomorrow because time difference. But Ben Hart, who has been a regular in our contests, it's his birthday this weekend. And he's
Happy
younger
birthday.
Than I thought. How old would you guess Ben is?
Oh, if I had to guess how old Ben is, 24?
Very close, 23. He's turning 23. That was really close. I was like, you're making me feel old. Like, how am I 10 years older than you? And by 10, I mean 13.
Because you and I are very close in age. I don't know exactly when your birthday is, but we are less than a year apart.
Yeah. We are. So yeah, Ben's still a baby, but a very wise one, I said to him. He has some very in-depth poetry. And he made us an audio clip for tonight. Let me just find it. Okay, there we go.
Crucifix Rift, a poem by Ben Hart. 1. American nicotine. Smoke leaving cigarette wick. Black cat hurries to a suburban hunting ground. I suddenly miss the bitter kick, that self-hate invasion at the back of my mouth. American nicotine is too sweet for these fleeting symphonies, playing pretend hide-and-seek with the same 3 minutes of misery played on repeat, telling ourselves each one was unique, worthy of a memory. And do you want to know what the worst thing is? There's tea in the thermos, but it won't be warm anymore because I poured it when we were still in love. When the lines in my hands matching up as I made them into a mask was still like art to you, made for the museum of movement, you'd say as if God cared for compliments, when all he wanted was for you to ask why he was hiding in blinded plain sight. Often on miscellaneous canvases, a crucifix rift in the clouds you happened to miss when you called the day Confederate. And why I was looking for hope in hands I've only ever known to be empty, never to know my beautiful symmetry until I was well into my 20s, when ecstasy had long lost the fight against depression. And if everything's a portal, is the one I'm supposed to stick my head through before I kick away the kitchen stool a shortcut back to a world that has Robin Williams in it? Because if so, I'm going. Spare you the eyes too blue for 22, who thought you only wanted to be seen in the moment, but you wanted me to see something through, and so you petrified my cowardice and made me distill asymmetry in your museum of movement. And of course, you call everything you left behind the past. You took one look at me and saw only the ashes, lint buried beneath your fingernails, black pushing me back through the cracks in the pavement you lay over my grave. Drinking the tepid tea from the thermos, and what rotten romance I had left bitter to you tasted sweet, like American nicotine. 2. Violet Bride. You were picking petals from your blue bridal bouquet and let them dissolve into your skin, covering the tattoos of your youth, the cuts and clefts you made to escape your peripheral prison. And they'll call you a hero, because you never gave up. But they'll make one mistake, thinking you saved her, the girl Mother Earth birthed, when all you really did was outlive her. And not that it matters, but in your violet eyes I saw the burning of Eden, and blood on the stone by which Eve rid herself of Adam, and angels trying to fly home, making more angels in acidic snowfall, and the tides coming in, returning shipwrecks to shore, but never the gold. I said, I love you, and you said, how bold. End poem.
Well, thank you for the SoundCloud, Ben. I don't think I've heard a SoundCloud that you've done before. So I really enjoyed that. It was great hearing your voice and the cadence with which you read. This was really interesting to me. The first part, you know, American nicotine, smoke leaving a cigarette with black cat hurries to a suburban hunting ground. You're painting like this picture, you're painting this image of something that's not good for you, but that's too sweet, like almost cloying and addictive, as like a metaphor for this relationship. But it also keeps like this tea, you know, this drink too, that has gotten cold. You know, which I equate to like the passion and the heat of the relationship. You know, when it was poured, everything was hot and wonderful and delicious, and it just kind of faded. You know, and at the narrator here, you know, feels used. You know, that it took them a while to see the beauty in themselves. And by that time, things had just kind of gotten weak, you know, having gone through depression and gone through horrible things. I really related to the line, and if everything is a portal, is the one I'm supposed to stick my head through before I kick away the kitchen stool, a shortcut back to a world that has Robin Williams in it, because if so, I'm going. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, a metaphor here for hanging yourself, you know, to kick the stool out while you stick your head through something, you know, the idea of a portal being a noose, and that suicide is like a path back to a different place or a different time. And that you'd fantasize about one that has Robin Williams in it, you know, I don't cry a lot. I've mentioned that a few times. I kind of struggle with it. I wish I could cry more. I wish I was better at expressing those feelings, but I'm just not. But I did cry when Robin Williams died. He was such a huge part of my childhood and so many of my favorite films and so many of the things growing up that really contributed to, you know, my entertainment. Like, he entertained me all through my childhood and up to my adulthood. And even as I got older and discovered his older work, you know, that was not child appropriate, you know. It really kind of, in a large way, shaped my worldview. You know, and to know someone who was laughing and smiling and so wonderful and did so many wonderful things for me was really struggling with depression and drug addiction and, you know, Alzheimer's or Lewy body. You know, was really disheartening. But to think that, like, via, like, suicide, you can stick your head into a portal and go back to it another time that is more lighthearted, I thought was really artfully conveyed here. It's such a short stanza, and yet that's so, like, layered and contextualized and cultural on top of that. Like, this is a very complex stanza right there that says a lot without going into too many details. But I enjoyed it very much. I also liked this concept of movement that you kind of tied throughout here as well. You know, this museum of movement, you know, where, you know, things that were alive are just kind of put on display now. It's referenced a couple times, you know, in your hands that were made into a mask. And then again, later when you're talking about your asymmetry and made me the still asymmetry in your museum of movement. It's something that used to be alive, something that used to be vibrant and have motion and to have changed and become so much colder, you know, to turn to a tepid tea and that, you know, what used to be really great, you realize is just too sweet. And then in the second section here, I feel like this is about how this other person wasn't okay either, you know, kind of hiding the depression that they went through, the pain that they went through, you know, using petals to cover up scars, you know, sounds like from cutting, you know, and self-harm, and that everyone lauds her because she's still alive, she made it through. You know, she didn't stick her head into the portal and kick out the stool or, you know, cut too deep or whatever the case may be. But the person that used to be there, that vibrant and alive person, isn't anymore. You know, in your violent eyes, I saw the burning of Eden and the blood on the stone by which Eve rid herself of Adam. You know, and then, you know, the earth birth is not there anymore. And all that innocence is lost, all the joy is lost. And, yeah, you're still alive, but you're not the person you used to be. And so then at the end, and I like that it rhymes, too, at the end, by the way, the gold and the bold, to say, you know, and the tide's coming in, returning shipwrecks to the shore, but never the gold. You know, so the treasure's gone. And then this is, and I love you, and you said, how bold. So to love someone anyway, despite the loss, despite the change, despite not being who they used to be, to love them anyway, I thought was really powerful. And to see the reflections of the two pieces in each other, I feel like talking about that loss is the equivalent of talking about that museum of motion in the first part. So I really enjoyed this piece. I could probably talk about it for a while. I feel like I've already talked about it for a while. Very well done, Ben. Thank you. Tiziana, what did you think?
Well, I liked everything you had to say. I thought this was amazing. Very striking poem. An example of how, like, I'm baffled by how Ben is so creative and insightful and just, like, it feels, like, full of wisdom to me. And he's even talked about, like, into his late 20s when he's in this character. And, I mean, he's not into his late 20s yet, but he's able to, you know, projects that feeling. I really liked the line, that self-hate invasion buried in the back of my mouth. That is such an interesting way to talk about smoking or any kind of bad habit, that self-hate invasion, the bitter kick of smoking. I've never smoked, like, ever in my life, and it just doesn't appeal to me at all. But to do it, knowing that it's bad for you and not enjoying it, if it's that bitterness and it doesn't really do anything good for you, but it's the self-hate, that's such a powerful way of putting that. And then I really love, in the next section, playing pretend hide-and-seek with the same 3 minutes of misery played on repeat. So I feel like that could go a whole bunch of different ways. But say it takes you 3 minutes to smoke that cigarette, and that's his self-invasion, his self-hate invasion, where during those cigarettes that he doesn't even like, so bitter, that's when he, like, lets himself remember or pushes it out of his mind, it could go either way, the negative feelings about everything. So maybe it's when he clears his head and he focuses on that self-hatred of the cigarette and doesn't have to think about the miseries of life. Or maybe it's when he allows himself to focus on them. I'm not sure. But those playing hide-and-seek with those 3 minutes of misery is just a very intriguing notion. And whether those 3 minutes are when he's hiding or when he's finding it, I think it works really well. For you to pretend that each time was unique and worthy of a memory, and maybe that is talking about, like, each time he was with someone. You know, if maybe each time they had sex, maybe each time they connected, and telling yourself that it was special and something to remember, when maybe that other person didn't really care about that moment. It wasn't special to them. Because I poured it when we were still in love. There's something about carrying around that thermos long afterwards, maybe wanting to drink it when the love is rekindled, when it's hot again. And I think that that's a good metaphor, because maybe he's carrying around those feelings and those memories, and they're not warm anymore. It's cold and it's sad, but he's still carrying them around, hoping that someday they'll be light again. That's a really powerful metaphor. Sorry, I'm just scrolling through trying to find parts that I wanted to talk about. I mean, you said pretty much everything that needs to be said about the Robin Williams part, but that really struck me as well. The kick away the kitchen stool, you describing it as a portal. You know, he doesn't come out and say suicide. He doesn't actually say about killing yourself, but it's very clear that that's what this is referring to. And Robin Williams is such a good choice for this, because it is, you know, that lighthearted kind of wonder before you knew Robin Williams was suffering, before you lost him. A world that has Robin Williams in it is something that you would want a shortcut back to. And then also, because Robin Williams killed himself, to kill yourself as a portal to Robin Williams, it's like maybe you'll end up where he was. And it's a whole complicated thing, but I really appreciated that stanza. And then in the second section, I really liked the part that says, they'll make one mistake thinking you saved her, the girl Mother Earth birthed, when all you really did was outlive her. The idea that she didn't kill herself during that time of self-harm, And so people are like, yay, you preserved that girl that you were. And no, you outlived her. Wow. I mean, you articulated it much better, Babbler, but I am just in awe of the way that that was put together. Wonderful. Very intense and intelligent and emotional poem. And I really liked getting an audio from you. So thank you very much, Ben Hart.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I'm just going to double check I don't have an audio. Oh, yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, I also really liked that phrasing, you know, to have outlived. Yeah, like she's dead. You know, the innocence that the person you used to be is no longer here. But your body still lives, but the person has changed. It makes me think of, like, that philosophical argument, you know, of, like, if you could replace your body piece by piece, you know, at what point are you no longer you, you know? Like, you can apply it to a machine, too. Like, if you have a robot and you replace part after part after part, you know, at what point is it a new robot? You know, the philosophical argument, you know, that kind of implies soul. But if you change a little bit of your personality and who you are, a piece and a piece and a piece at a time, you know, at what point are you not that person anymore? You know, I think it's a really interesting thought. Way to apply it to people without, like, implicating, you know, a soul necessarily. But anyway, I enjoyed the way that was written.
Me too. Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm lost in that poem. Good job, Ben, because I'm having trouble moving on. The next poem is by Jenny Hunt, 2017, and it's called Violet Wonder Blossoms. Sticking up for the little guy tickles me pink, exquisite, friendly minx, letting her kindness shine, illuminating my darkened experiences, immediately making us friends. Never will I forget what she has done for me. Appreciating you always, girl, as the sky is blue. A pen to my paper. Let us keep on penning. Apple to my eye as you bring sparkle to my life. Violet essence you are, releasing my depression. End poem. And this is an acrostic poem. So it says, Selena Mav. And it says, it's a reference to a blossoming poetic friendship with Stelina, who is a member of Late Night Poets and a wonderful poet and singer. And a MAV is a software project management and comprehension tool. And that was something that Stelina helped her comprehend with her purple violet essence. Cheers to friends. That was a wonderful AN. Thank you for letting us know about that, Jenny.
Acrostics. I have a love-hate relationship with acrostics. I love acrostics when I have to be like, oh, this is an acrostic. I hate acrostics when I'm like, this is an acrostic. You know, like, if it dawns on me afterwards that this is an acrostic, because the flow and the message and the way the poem worked together worked so well that I didn't notice right away that it was an acrostic, I consider that a win. If I'm like, what the heck is this disjointed piece of poetry, why are these words in the order that they are, and I'm like, oh, it's an acrostic. For pretty much all forms of poetry, in my opinion, you know, the form should be used to enhance the message, not hinder. And that's just my opinion. But that's how, you know, it's art. I get to have one of those. And I think this works well. you know, this wasn't one where I was instantly like, this is an acrostic, because it has a message and it's not hindered by the form. You know, sticking up for the little guy tickles me pink, exquisite, friendly minx, letting her kindness shine. Like, that flows. It flows well. It's not stopped by the fact that it's an acrostic. So I think it's well done there, which is, this form in general is kind of a hard sell for me. And it's such a lovely write to a friend. You know, it says why you like them. You know, they stick up for the little guy. You know, they're a champion for people who get bullied or aren't seen, and highlight other people's experiences. You know, they're friendly, they're kind, they illuminate your darkened experiences. You know, they help you feel happier, which is, you know, a big deal, like enjoying someone's personality, you know, can immediately be friends. So I like that. I think, you know, the message isn't lost, and it's such a wonderful tribute to Selena. You know, and then on this end piece, you know, pen to my paper, let us keep on penning. Apple to my eye as you bring sparkle to my life. Violet essence you are, releasing my depression. It sounds like it could equally be about Selena as it could be about the MAV. You know, let's just keep writing. You know, let's keep expressing ourselves. And I think that's wonderfully done. So I enjoyed this. I thought it was a good acrostic. So thank you, Jenny. Your thoughts, Ephesiana?
I have to agree with you. I'm not usually a big fan of acrostics because usually it really stands out to me as that they're just trying to make the words fit. But I actually didn't notice that this was an acrostic until I saw it in the AN. So I think that's a really good sign that I wouldn't have focused on the first letters, that I was paying attention to the words. That says a lot. I love the word minx, and that was in there, so that made me happy. And I like that it was a tribute to friendship. You know, so many times we have poems about lovers or exes or maybe family, but not often enough are friends given the tribute that they deserve. So it's really lovely to have that. And it's not even old friends, it's new friends. And like the recognition of blossoming friendship. I think that's a really beautiful thing to focus on. And Selena's lovely, so I'm happy that those two have started to bond because they're both wonderful from my experience talking to them online. So thank you very much, Jenny, for sharing that with us. Our next poem is by Daniel Deschino, and this is his response to Violet. So, Babbler, can you please give that a read?
Absolutely. This is The Magenta Beginning of a Violet Past by Daniel Deschino. I have awakened to Violet, to the end of separated vision, but yet I always feel like that, as if there is only a past, no future until it is. And when it is, there is Violet. A cousin to burning death, a sibling to the healing blues of the world, the last note strummed on the rainbow harp. I am always Violet, always on the edge of forever, always at the farthest point, the treasures of kings past, the fading fountain of sunlight glory. Once I am Violet, I will have become me. Epilogue. My eyes, my focus, the universe itself, a collection of colors, reflection to represent perception. In between the ominous tranquility of blue sky and the noble dark clouds marching, conspiring, nurturing the smiling death, between these worlds rainbows live, as an angel's harp and an artist's palette, symphonic painting on everything I see. So to rainbows I run, hoping for a climb skyward or a dig to complete the circle. But it is always out of reach and eventually gone. But the elements, the fire of the sun, nurturing water, canvas of air, the cradle of earth of which I stand, show me the ethereal elemental brilliance of rainbow wisdom. everything too separate. It was really part of the one, the light of the world. End poem.
Great read, Babbler. I like how he related it to the other colors, a cousin to burning death, a sibling to the healing blues, relating to those other colors. And he did, I believe, write to every color in the rainbow. So I think he's referring to his own poems as well as to the colors and those connections. I also like thinking of the rainbow as a harp, where each one is a string, and you can play the music on it, the last note strummed. And then to think of it as being the end, the edge of forever, the farthest point, it kind of makes me think of you know, the leprechaun seeking the end of the rainbow, and the catch me lucky charms just came to mind when I'm picturing, like, trying to get to the end of the rainbow, which is not right because this is a more serious poem, but for some reason that's where my head went. Catch me lucky charms, which I'm imitating the cereal commercial, not an actual Irish person, just to clarify. I find it interesting that the epilogue is longer than the body. You know, normally an epilogue is shorter than the, say, novel itself. But this kind of reminds me of like a fantasy novel where there's always like such a big intro. God, what is the opposite of epilogue? Brain failing. Prologue. the huge prologue preparing you for things, and then the actual body of the thing, and then huge epilogue because so much happens that you just need to know about the world that has been built here. And I feel like Daniel has built a world in each of his poems about the colors, and so the epilogue is kind of needed, and it's interesting that he included that. Where is it now? I like the wording of in between the ominous tranquility of blue sky and the noble dark clouds marching, conspiring. The idea of the clouds in the storm being, you know, malicious. I like that they're conspiring, nurturing with smiling death. And it's between the calm blue and the dark clouds that we do find rainbows. And to note that in such a like animated, personified way is really fun. And symphonic painting on everything I see. I like that because it is like a musical experience, how varied the hues are. It's like it creates a spectrum like it would be for sound. And so to connect it again as the harp, I know Daniel's a musician, so for him to think of the color palette as the sound range as well just seems to connect nicely. And then again, he talks about the different elements, the fire of the sun, nurturing the water, the canvas of air, the cradle of the earth. To have all of those elements connect really works nicely for a conclusion about how all the colors made it through the rainbow. So I feel like this epilogue is definitely not just specifically to his violet poem, but to the series of poems about color.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this piece as well. I thought it was interesting, too, that it's the magenta beginning of a violet past, a magenta being kind of the bridge, right, between red and purple. Not if you get too deep into color theory, but on the surface level of color theory. I liked that, you know, to do the reconnection, the parts of the whole, I thought was beautifully done. You know, I am always violet on the edge of forever, always at the farthest point. The treasures of kings past the fading foundation of sunlight glory. You know, the end of things, always at the edge, right? You always live in the now. Tomorrow you can't quite get to. You know, just riding the wave of time is kind of what it makes me think of. You know, you can't go back, you can't go forward, you're just, you know, always right on the edge. You know, and I really liked this epilogue, you know, that does that tying out all together, you know, the idea of digging for the rainbow, you know. You thought of the Lucky Charms. I thought of this really stupid video that I saw on TikTok of this woman who sees a rainbow and has always wanted to touch the end of a rainbow. And the end looks like it's right there. And so she has her husband take her phone while she runs over and tries to get to the end of the rainbow. And, of course, you can't see it when you're in it. Like, you can't actually touch a rainbow because of the way, you know, the light fractioning works. You can't see it when you're right there. So she's having her husband, like, am I there? Am I touching it? Am I touching it? Am I touching it? But she doesn't just want to touch the rainbow. She's, like, humping the rainbow. It's a hysterical but absolutely waste of time, silly video. But, you know, whatever brings joy, right? And I thought it was hilarious. But the whole reason she wanted to get to the end of the rainbow was to hump it. not to find a pot of gold or anything else, you know? you know, when I pictured that, when it's like the end of the rainbow. But knowing that it's an arc that goes in a complete circle. You know, I've seen a couple complete circle rainbows, but not a lot. But the idea of digging through, the digging under to connect the circle, I thought was a really interesting take, you know. And then all the different ways that you can perceive light, you know, the fire of the sun, nurturing water, the light in the water, canvas of air, you know, all the different things that can be, you know, painted on a canvas or just strewn across the sky, and you know, all the different things that we perceive that require light perceive. I thought it was a really well done way to do this, you know, that everything that seems separate is really part of the one, the light of the world. I thought it was really a great way to end this out. And then, of course, I see that nod in this footnote here about that he did the soapbox of brown. It's brown itself. we'll get to brown. Anyway, I enjoyed the write. I thought it was very well done too.
Very good. Our next poem, we are privileged to have an audio. So this is Between Goldberg and Winfrey by Eric Svensson.
Between Goldberg and Winfrey. Oh, whoopee, you color me purple. My rooted red rainbow beginning taken, pulled right up to purples 335 to 380 nanometers. Tie-dye days of perseverance, ponder wonder beneath South Africa's bleak, bleary rainbow cadence. Sweet-scented purple rain wisteria crowns a poet's didactic diadem. Oh, Oprah, purple prose and a school for girls in Johannesburg, South Africa. Nelson Mandela pressed your button and you responded. Paid it forward from your own rooted red hardship. Established an elite girls' school where ribald Rastafarian energy pulsates. Synergistics of mauve years when our newly born rainbow nation shone. 30 years later, angry rooted red tarnishes our bleak blanched rainbow. Promised purple diadems for grassroots masses reneged on by corruption. Oh, let's cry, my beloved country, weep and gnash our teeth. Purple colors so much nowadays, makeshift coffins draped with purple remnants, dusty purple African violets flounder in glass bottles beside makeshift crosses. Soon our threadbare, bleak rainbow nation may fade forever. The devilish truth can no longer be concealed by purple prose. Oh, between rooted red and princely purple ideals, hope survives between greens 565 and 520 nanometers. Daily heart surgery done on a country's ailing heart. Faithful citizens pray for peace, but most of all, the end of corruption. Thorned violence crowns, drapes cadavers in purple cloth. The color purple movie plays itself out, but yeah, same dog eats same dog. Only faith vertical lightning conductor arcs justified rooted red anger. End poem.
Oh, this is a really fascinating, right? I feel like there's a lot going on here. I don't think I'm going to catch it all on this first read, but I'll talk a little more about the, you know, pieces that I really did understand. Reading, you know, the my rooted red rainbow, beginning to pull right up to purples 335 to 380 nanometers, that being the spectrum of visible light that appears as purple. Tie-dye days of perseverance, ponder wonder beneath South Africa's bleak, bleary rainbow cadence. I think we're talking about South Africa, and just kind of what's going on there. And, you know, this is what the color purple conjures. And interestingly, I also kind of envision the color purple when I think of Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah Winfrey. I don't really know why, but purple is definitely the color that I would have picked for either one of those women. I'm not entirely sure what their ties are necessarily to South Africa. You know, Oprah here does mention that she opened a school for girls in Johannesburg, and that, you know, she has connections with Nelson Mandela, and the way that she's invested into, South African education, you know, establish an elite girls' school where ribald Rastafarian energy pulsates. Synergistics of mo of years when our newly born rainbow nation shone, you know, injected this energy into the community with her contributions. You know, 30 years later, angry rooted red tarnishes our bleak blanched rainbow. Promised purple diadems for grassroots masses reneged on by corruption. Like, corruption has ruined this. You know, the dream was like this purple energy, this joy, this hope that corruption has kind of tainted and turned more into a red, angry color. You know, oh, let's cry, my beloved country, weep and gnash our teeth. Purple colors so much nowadays, makeshift coffins draped with purple remnants. You know, this purple being draped over a coffin, and that being, you know, what's painting things purple. You know, it's so dark. You know, it's it's rather bleak use of the color purple. And I think it represents, again, like, you know, that death of joy. And just kind of, I don't know, it brings the darkness back into it. And then, you know, the rainbow kind of just fading, you know, the dusty purple African violets flounder in glass bottles beside crosses. You know, they're being left at graves, kind of left to wither. Between rooted red and princely purple ideals, hope survives between greens 565 and 20 nanometers. So instead of these two opposite ends, the purple and the red, you know, instead of painting things in like black and white and good and evil, I'm kind of finding this middle ground. And here it being green, again, you know, that being a spectrum of light. Daily heart surgery done on a country's ailing heart. Like, things are falling apart, but people are still trying. There's still hope. People are trying to end the corruption. They're praying for peace. Like, they're doing what they can. You know, you've got these cadavers of purple cloth, and that is kind of playing itself out. But hopefully you can find, you know, this neutral. It's kind of what I'm getting out of it, you know, the good and the evil. But things don't really solely exist on that kind of a spectrum. You have to take more of a center on it. So that being green. I'm sure I miss a lot of things, but I thought this was a really beautiful and heartfelt and passionate piece, that felt, you know, kind of close to home. Something that's felt strongly about, and not just felt strongly about, but known, you know, well informed. So I enjoyed this. Thank you, Eric Swenson. What did you think, Fabiana?
Well, it says in the AN he was an investigative journalist in South Africa, so I think he would be quite knowledgeable, certainly more than I. So I'm sort of ignorant about the history and the current politics, but I do know that The Color Purple was the name of a movie based on a book that Whoopi Goldberg and Oprah were both in, and that film and book, although I haven't read it myself, were about the struggles of African Americans in historical United States, who, you know, faced poverty and racism and sexism and domestic violence. So there's a lot of struggles within that story. And then it's, I think, compared or contrasted with the struggles in South Africa. But I kind of wonder if, because purple is the color of royalty in the past in Europe, if purple is in some points here colonialism, and the purple that's draped over the coffins, is it connecting the deaths and the war to colonialism? Again, I don't know my South African history, so I am, you know, just going off the tip of my brain, and I apologize if I'm, you know, totally, totally out there. And I mean no disrespect to the people of South Africa or to Eric Swenson for not knowing what I am talking about there. But that's just where my mind went, is that because we talked about purple being royal, if it was somehow connected to the way that South Africa was treated. Because the one thing I do know is that there was quite a divide between white South Africa and black South Africa, and Nelson Mandela was involved in that with getting the indigenous black people the power in fighting the colonialism, I think. Again, I'm sorry, I'm ignorant ignorant of history, but making those connections, even with Oprah, it's saying that, you know, she gave it, she gave help, you know, thinking about her own past that was rooted in hardships, with red hardships, so like, you know, bloody past, but she established an elite girls' school, and I kind of wonder if that's talking about how, even though she's helping, like, the rich. She's maybe, you know, being somewhat selective in her help. Now, I don't know this, but I just kind of wondered, the fact that it pointed out as an elite school, and then it talks about the little coffins that are being put together later, if it's contrasting the lucky children who got to go to that school and those who were left behind in the war. I really don't know enough to comment, but I think that this is an intelligent piece, and it's enough that I want to look things up. So it feels like it has potential to be educational, and it just feels full of feeling. You can tell that he cares about what's going on here and that he knows what he's talking about, even though I don't.
Yeah, I agree a lot with what you said, and I'm sure that there is, I like especially what you're talking about the misguided aid, you know, the that, right? Like, it's an elite girls' school. It's, you know, that's not doing anything to curb the corruption. Similar to you, though, I don't feel like I'm well-informed enough to make, like, a really educated opinion. But I think it prods that wanting that knowledge, so I think that that's a good sign.
Okay. We are somewhat low on time, and we have quite a few poems left, so there will be carryovers, but I'm going to choose the next two based on the fact that we have audios for them, and since we have those loaded, let's do the ones where people have provided audios, and then the rest of them will most likely be carried over. So this next one is by G.A. Grimm, and it's called Purple. You know what? Never mind, because I actually don't see that in the studio. So I'm going to save G.A. Grimm's, because it has an audio, for next time when we will get that audio. And I will play Naomi's, because we do have that one. I see it. And that is my bad. So I'm sorry, George. We'll get you next time. Naomi. Here she is.
Midsummer by Naomi Sarah. Midsummer drifted in on the soft warmth of the July breeze under patches of violet blue sky. It was then that the petals of the lilac tree that hugged our house darkened to the deepest of purples, and Mom would shake her crunched-up little fists after the quickened footsteps of the neighborhood passerbys who'd broken off a few branches to carry a prized bouquet home. As we raced through yards playing hide-and-seek and sketched chalky boxes with big rainbow numbers into the beaten sidewalk for a game of hopscotch, our eyes dancing until laughs bubbled over as we chanted made-up rhymes to every jump and beat of a tired pink skipping rope hitting the cracked asphalt. And every afternoon at 3 o'clock sharp, we crowded to both sides of the street, listening for whistling old Mike, who gave all the kids' gum the flavor of soapy suds in every juicy chew. But what we waited for most was to see the black crow that perched on his shoulder and squawked on command, encircling him as an army of rosy-cheeked, tiny soldiers with mouths of sweet lavender, gawking at the inky feathers and squeaking and squirming at every rustle of wings Caw, caw, caw.
I really liked this piece, Naomi. Thank you so much for the recording. I love to hear you read your pieces. Adds just something to it, just with the way you read. I can really feel the nostalgia in this piece. I'm not going to lie, part of me, when I read the Midsummer, the warmth of the July breeze, and they talk about the lilac tree, I'm like, that's not July! That's just me being a plant stickler. And when you talk about nostalgia things, like, this kind of stuff just blurs together, you know? As a kid, are you really paying attention to that? No. So I think it works perfectly. It's just my own internal dialogue that's just like, hey! I loved the
But read her again. Read her again, because that explains it.
Okay, I'll get there. I haven't gotten to that yet. Okay, so I'll read the AN real quick. But it says, growing up, we lived in northern Quebec near the sea, and if we got 2 warm weeks of summer in the whole year, it was good. So we did make most of it, and lilacs bloomed late. I wonder if they're that late. That would be like 3 months late. I'll have to look it up. That's fascinating. But anyway, that's just my own internal thing. And I feel really fortunate to live where I do, too, because lilacs are kind of picky plants. But they do really well here. But I love all of the really specific messages in this, because that's how nostalgia works, right? You remember all these weird little snippets that piece together, kind of paint your childhood. And they put together that feeling, like you remember the way that you felt, and you see it from this lens of just like, these were good times. Even if the moment wasn't a good time, even if it was like, oh, I remember that time I, you know, really scraped up my knee and like bled all the way home. It still gets filed away in like this nostalgic moment. And it's always interesting to see what sticks and what doesn't. I really loved this part where your mom is like shaking her fist at these plant thieves. It reminds me of this time. My mom had rose bushes that were out by the curb, and people all the time would come and just help themselves, and she'd get so mad. And then one time we were out there, and this lady came up, and she asked, do you mind if I clip some roses? And my mom said, I'd really rather you not. I like to enjoy them. And she clipped a bunch anyway and stuffed them all in her mouth. Like, ate the roses, which we were just really shocked into silence about. And then she went running down the street. It was a really weird time. I'll never forget it, just because it was so bizarre. But, you know, all these things that you just remember, and they're all beautifully specific. You know, the made-up rhymes and the skipping rope and the chalk boxes. And then very specifically, this whistling old Mike who's handing out gum, soapy suds gum, too, in every juicy chew, which I assume is like a juicy fruit. But it could also be something else, something, you know, it's a different country, so there's quite possibly stuff I haven't had. Makes me think of what I used to call monkey butt gum. That is not the name of the gum, but you'd chew it and you'd get like... maybe 2 minutes of good taste out of it, and then it would just taste like what I call monkey butt. It's not good. You have to spit it out. And this really cool crow that he had, you know, domesticated or tamed on his shoulder, that would squawk and caw at things, and just how cool that would be. I love this. I loved all of the specific little things that kind of paint the picture of childhood. She has added inspirational photos here, too. So there's the lilac blossoms, and then there's also hopscotch drawn out in chalk. And there's a picture of the gum. It's called Thrills. It's colored purple, and it literally says on it, it still tastes like soap. Why would you want that? Now I'm just really curious about this nasty soap gum this guy would hand out to kids. This is really fun. I love this. This is a trip down nostalgia lane. Wonderfully done, Naomi. Thank you. Aviviana, your thoughts?
I loved it. And I can confirm, as someone who has lived in cold places, things bloom way later. There's a very brief time of blooming. Like, my parents' house right now is still very snowy. There's quite a bit of snow on the roof that is a concern that is going to melt off and fall on their dog. I know that even though they have lilac trees, they are definitely not going to bloom when ours do. I love the mom in it, too, and the way that it's described. Mom would shake her crunched-up little fists. You know, this is not a big woman. Her crunched-up little fists. She can hear the quickening footsteps. So you have the sound of it. You have the mother's hands. You can picture, like, the way that they're crunched and the little wrinkles that would come with that. I'm picturing, like, the coloring of, like, you can see, like, the white where her nails are digging into her hand. That I like that the lilac tree hugged the house because it probably grew into it. You know, it starts off as a separate entity, and then it just grows and grows until it's, like, now wrapping around the house. Because that's just, I don't know, our lilac tree, like, went nuts and took over so much that my family actually would encourage people to take a little bit too because it was too big for our yard. But I love the idea of this mom being mad. And also, absolutely crazy, your story about the person who put it in their mouth after she was told no. Like, what the hell? Like, and also, roses are thorny. Like, that would be so risky and uncomfortable.
I mean, it was just the rose head, but also my mom doesn't, she's really lucky actually because my mom doesn't spray her roses with anything. So like there's nothing on there. Like there's no pesticides or anything. So she's really lucky in that respect. But on the other side, they are completely infested with aphids. Like she just put so many bugs in her mouth. I'm shocked by that moment now, years later, like decades later, I think about it sometimes. I'm just like, what was up with that nut job?
Wow. Weird when lady. You write your memoir, hence, you know the word I'm trying to say. When you write that, it needs to include that story.
The lady who ate the roses.
Yes, please put that in there. It should be like this little thing between chapters or something. Like you got to put that story in there.
We'll see.
Oh, that's amazing.
Why not? I do think about it randomly.
I like that the hopscotch is there, and it's into the beaten sidewalk. It's like, it's not like a fresh, you know, posh neighborhood. It is worn down sidewalk with the hopscotch lines that you really have to dig in, because I remember having sidewalks like that where it's not like you can just draw a line because there's like the little grooves and stuff. It's like you got to get that chalk in there so it will actually make its mark. It's a different kind of sidewalk. And then the laughs bubbling over. I enjoy the phrasing there. And it's a tired pink skipping rope. This is not a fresh rope either. This is one that has been lasting a few years. It's kind of fallen apart. I had some of those. And then, like, usually there's kind of, like, the plastic end piece on it that's, like, cracked, and it cuts your hand a little bit as you I can really picture that the tired pink skipping rope hitting the cracked asphalt, and having the cracked asphalt really is hard on the skipping rope and is exactly why the hopscotch lines are not straight. The details in this just create such nostalgia and make me feel like it's true stories. And then old Mike. I mean, honestly, I kind of want to be that crazy person in the town. I want to be the witch who lives on the edge of town, handing out candy with a crow. I mean, I love the idea of having, like, a crow familiar. Wow. Okay, so just be prepared. In a few years, I will be like old Mike. I like that he has, like, his precise timing, too. 3 o'clock. He's going to go there. And then that it's the gross gum. And I do remember having disgusting gum, but it was like, it was good for the first like two chews or something like that, you know? It was the really cheap stuff. Ours was pink, not purple. And it was hard as a rock. And like, it was just like, why would you even do it? But we would have like, you know, you have like two or three bites that taste good, and then it's just awful, and you got to spit it out real fast. But then there'd be some kid who like had like a competition of how long they could keep it in their mouth. I remember my brother and our neighbor Colin, like putting a whole bunch of them in their mouth at once and seeing like who could keep it in the longest, because it was so gross. Who could keep chewing? And I feel like this is like that kind of moment with that gross gum where it's like a challenge. You're trying to defeat the fact that it's like weird and like just gross. And just the way that this is all described with the squeaking and the squirming and the rustle of the wings and like then the like onomatopoeia kind of feeling of the caw, caw, caw. This is such a vivid image, and just hearing other stories from Naomi and her poems, I'm pretty sure this is all real. This sounds like it would be her reality, and I love that she shared this kind of nostalgia and the three things that struck her about purple. They fit really well together, and they're all purple in their own way.
Yeah, I like.
We have. No, it's okay. We have 4 minutes left, not enough time to read a poem. So, by all means, make your comment.
I was just saying that I also just love how personal. Like, you can't make up these details, like eating soaked gum and seeing the stupid crow. I mean, you could, but that's a real stretch. It feels very authentic. You know, it feels like a real childhood. And the weird things that you remember. That's just how it works. It's the weird things that you remember. Yeah. You know, my jump ropes always had, like, plastic, like, pieces over it. You know, it almost looked like macaroni, but it's not. It's just plastic. Every jump rope I ever have had those on it, and they'd break against the pavement, so you'd have chunks missing and missing ones, and so they'd get extra clacky sounding.
We could peel that off. Once it started to break, I would peel off the plastic.
Doing the shins, like, don't miss. Anyway.
When we were a little bit older, we would get free ones from school because we did jump rope for heart. It was like a fundraiser. And if you were going to get pledges on how much you could skip, they would give you a red skipping rope for free. Those were my best skipping ropes. And they were more like tubes. Like, they were a totally different kind of material.
I am very curious about this soap gum. It sounds so gross. It makes me want to try it.
I'm pretty sure that picture is like a joke one. It's like somebody photoshopped it to say the soap thing. It was one of those like, okay, what do you remember about the 80s kind of thing, and then they just like changed it. I don't think it said that on the real package.
I can buy it at Walmart right now, and it does say it still tastes like soap. So apparently that is, like, it's supposed to taste like soap.
It's a nostalgia thing, and now we want the soap. We are out of time. Thank you, everyone who wrote. We have a whole bunch of carryovers, so join us next week to enjoy those. And Babbler has some more contests that are still going on, so check out hers. And as soon as I do my judging, I will add some as well. Good night, everyone.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Night.